They have rebased this on the injection marks in the upper arm. Page 4 of my statement here.
By injection, they did?
Yes, and by gunfire. There were a lot more people killed by gunfire than they've ever admitted so far. We had heard reports that there were 50 of them, approximately 50 men with guns ringing around there so people couldn't get out. And very few of them did get out. According to the chief medical officer in Guyana, most of the people down there were murdered rather than suicide.
Who is suppressing all of this? Are you implying the CIA was active in the suppression?
Yes, I'm suggesting to you that a lot of things that don't make sense here. I'm suggesting that the long delay in anyone getting in, the press getting in there, or very many people all getting in there for several days, was caused by a deliberate attempt to manufacture the story, which has now been accepted and sold successfully to the American people.
And what is that story that you think the people are falsely accepting?
That, in effect, this was a large group of disillusioned disoriented black people who went down to Guyana and who turned their backs in this country and committed suicide, and we're rid of them, and that was just sort of an aberration type of thing. I think that's the story that's been peddled. When you see the documentation here, you'll begin to wonder yourselves why the first reports were 350 people died or 400 people died, and for several days that was reported, and then they started finding more bodies. When the first reports were that 500 fled in the jungle, the people examined the bodies the first time and counted them by name, by types of people, men, women, and children, turned them over. Then a few days later, they claimed to have found 2 and 3 stacks of bodies underneath those. You know, it boggles the mind, the stories that were passed out, but they apparently have gotten away with, I think, with one of the greatest fabrications of recent years.
And what do you think was really going on there?
You think is going on?
Whatever happened at Jonestown, I believe that our government, through the CIA, was in close touch with Jones before he left this country, that our government helped him to get established down there, ignored reports of brutality, ignored reports of guns being run down or drugs being sent down there, that our government used Jones, if nothing, at the minimum, to keep control of the government of Guyana for the prime minister we wanted down there. At the maximum, the possibility is that we may also have used it for a mass mind control experiment.
Do you think there is any connection between this surmise and the Larry Layton acquittal?
There is, but I can't quite figure out which it is. I never have figured that Larry Layton would ever be convicted of anything. He'll never be tried in this country. I think the long length of time it took to bring him to trial was so they could get everything in order, so they could arrange for nothing to come out, as has happened. Now, whether Layton was the innocent victim and was a setup, or whether he was actually under drugs, as they say here in this article, I don't know. There's a report in what I have attached here that actually were blanks in his gun. He was waving a blank gun around and firing a blank gun. He may have been a setup. This thing is so weird. It's such a never-never world that I really can't... Except that I believe that our government worked with the government of Guyana to bring about an acquitted verdict of Larry Layton. I don't think he'll ever be tried in this country for Leo's murder or for anything else.
What significance do you attach to the fact that the leadership of the temple was largely white and the membership of the temple was largely black?
I mentioned that in here. I think that that's part and parcel of the whole thing. I think that this is what caused me very suspicious about this whole experiment, about the possibilities here. You know, the cadre was all white, and yet we think of Jonestown as a bunch of black people who were committed suicide without mentioning that white cadre. And that doesn't quite add up. I think there are racist overtones to the whole thing.
What kind of racist overtones? What are you exactly alleging here?
I'm alleging that the media picture that was printed, that it was painted rather, and then brought out in print and so on, was that you don't have to worry about these people because they're crazy, they'll do anything, and they're not like us.
How far will the Congress take all of this?
I don't know. Bill Royer has been pushing hard on it. He's the man who was elected to take Leo's place, and he's been doing a good job. I now have Don Edwards interested and a few others back there interested, and they're starting to get interested because they're very busy, but all of a sudden they're starting to realize there's more to this. It's now before the Select Committee in the House. I don't expect much to come of that because they're very close to the CIA, but at least we're we're making some headway. We keep it going.
Do you feel threatened in as much as you're exposing the CIA here?
I don't know whether to feel threatened or not. If what I think is true, then possibly I'm in some danger, but except by getting it out in the open, I think that the danger would, to me, if there is any, would recede, because that way they I might become too visible if they were to, if anything would happen, I might have an accident that, you know, I can't worry about that any more than Leo could worry about it. You have to just go ahead and do what you think is right.
Before Leo Ryan left for Jonestown on that trip, there had been a press conference three blocks from where we're sitting right now in the People's Temple, where Mark Lane and Marceline Jones had alleged that the CIA was engaged in a campaign to destabilize Jonestown, to invade it, to attack it, to destroy the social experiment that they portrayed Jonestown as having been. Were you, as Representative Ryan's aide and Representative Ryan himself, aware of those allegations? Did you lend any credence to them? Did you have any knowledge yourselves of possible CIA involvement in any way of this?
We had no knowledge or any thought of any CIA involvement. We knew the charges were being made. We deemed those to be Lane's charges to prevent Leo's trip, to prevent Leo from finding out what was actually the truth, whatever it was at Jonestown. And, however, we were mindful enough of it that Thursday night before Leo went down there, we had a meeting with Don Harris and the NBC TV crew over at the Airport Hilton Hotel, and we discussed possible violence at Jonestown. And because of Mark Lane's charges that Leo's trip was going to be a CIA invasion, it was decided that evening by Leo and Don Harris and myself and others who were going, Bob Brown and others who were killed down there, that not to take any guns, including handguns, because any guns along might have meant that they could have claimed that that provocation was started by the Ryan delegation. So it was decided not to take any guns, and that we did put enough credence in Mark Lane's charges to try to defuse them so there would be no possibility they're being believed.
Do you have a theory about those 350 bodies and then the delay and then the 900? Did something happen between one wave of killings and the next?
I should preface this by saying that there can be 100 theories and then another 100 theories on top of it. The evidence or the statements here that are attached here seem to indicate the possibility that there was an attempt at suicide drills and suicide, you know, actual carrying out of the suicide, some of which worked and some of which didn't. That more than that, some of the people may have fled off into the jungle in sizable numbers trying to get away. And those people may have later been found and brought back and their bodies added to the original bodies.
Was there any autopsy results that might indicate time of death?
No, that's also attached here. No autopsies were performed, and we had, when our medical examiners went in, they did not perform autopsies, and that's one of the questions as to why not.
What was the drug experiment? Can you be more trying to understand it here? MK, what was it called?
From 1953 to 1974, the CIA conducted experiments under something called MK Ultra program. You recall the LSD experiments in this country? People jumping out of windows and the LSD experiments that George White, who was Colonel of Narcotics here, conducted around the country. Around parts of the world. This was control of individuals, control of groups, control of whole populations. We have scientists in this country and elsewhere, including back in the Nazi Germany, that believe you can control behavior. It's shades of what they call the Brave New World. And there have been experiments in prisons, in hospitals, along those lines. But this is what they were doing, okay?
Is that not called lithium, the drug?
Well, that was one of the several. I have a whole list of drugs that were used as experiments here. So by 1974, the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups and lawsuits had forced the government to stop these programs using prisons and hospitals. And Helms, then the director of the CIA, said that they had lost interest in mine because they were terminating it. The charge attached here is, and the things that I received, was they then went over into the private sector and started going into the matter of cults and religious groups and conducting their experiments there.
Does MK have any significance?
I don't know what the initials stand for. It's MK Ultra, and I know that people in Washington are very familiar with it. Before that, they had something called Operation Artichoke, which included killing a prominent American politician, just as an experiment. Something called COINTELPRO, and others.
Any evidence, documentation, notes, somebody keeping notes on the results of the test?
Yes, oh yes, and they have some of the, we have attached here some of those acts, photocopies, some of those results that they were gotten under Freedom of Information Act. And so I think when you read the, especially the one from the penal colony and the one from the Associate Preservation of Religious Liberty, you'll see the reason why I felt moved to do something. I should say that I first heard his reports right after the tragedy in Guyana, within a few months, and I disbelieved them. I just thought it was ridiculous, and I just, for a year, I paid no attention to it. Until then I heard about the wire being down there and going back in and realized it was a covert operation. Then I testified in Washington in February, and then I got this material. I've only been on this trail for 2 months now, but it's all come because of my testimony in Washington. The other things were starting to, the more we talk, the more we find out, the more information comes to us. I'm here today to ask the help of this group, this Black Professional Leadership Group, and they're asked for their assistance in finding out more.
What is their reaction?
I'd say it was a mixed reaction. Some of them were suspicious that I was who I was. Was I really trying to divert attention, you see, from what the reality was? I think they were receptive, and I think they're going to go along and decide.
When you say divert from the reality, what do you mean?
Well, they were concerned that I was trying to maybe somehow suggest a CIA plot just to, there might be some other truth to it, and that I was sent here to divert attention from whatever reality it might be.
Would you be kind enough to summarize what you think was being done to the People's Temple people through the CIA? You started to say use of drugs, but what do you think really happened down there in the way of the mind control?
I think they were conducting, I really believe that there's a strong possibility, I'll have to put it this way, without being able to prove it, it's my impression at this time that they were conducting some sort of mind control experiments. For example, they had a very modern hospital down there which they bragged about. So modern that in that population, they had medical checkups for everyone every day. So there's no need for that unless you're conducting experiments where you're having control groups and you're giving people, and they're giving them their vitamins every day. And it's my guess that they were just using them as guinea pigs to see what they could do under isolated circumstances. They'd take them off into a jungle someplace far away from everybody. They get them there somehow, and then they're able to see how these various drugs work on different groups. Because of the medical checkups every day and the large number of drugs that I found down there, I'm inclined to believe that there was a mind control experimentation going on. And because of the links we now have through Dwyer and through Philip Blakey, I'm inclined to see some CIA involvement there. Whether that adds up to a full-scale government program of mind control, I do not know. But there's enough there that it needs to be investigated thoroughly.
What are the implications for other cults and organizations that we now have here in Northern California, such as, for example, the Moonies? We just had a national leader elected of the Moonies, the Hare Krishnas in Berkeley, who it turns out have submachine guns. And other organizations like that. Do you think there's a possibility that there's some relationship between the kind of thing you're talking about?
These documents claim that. Just a moment, please.
I have an extra copy if you want.
Thank you. Yes, the statements are made in here that the Korean CIA, they tab as the money source for the Moonies, for the Reverend Sung Young Moon. They talk about Synanon and some of Synanon's experimentation. Now, whether or not this is part and parcel, they question Moonies, they question Synanon, they question the great growth of the cult movement in the early 70s, about the time they were swinging away, that they were closing down, supposedly, the CIA MK Ultra program.
So what are you doing now?
Real estate development. Industrial real estate development. Yeah.
What exactly are the reasons that you think that Layton, that you expected Layton to be acquitted?
Well, primarily that as a surviving member of the People's Temple and somebody that he was dangerous to the authorities, if he did know anything and talked on the grounds that they were going to, if they were going to execute him or put him long term in prison, he just might talk to get even or to prevent being sent to prison or being executed. So I think that Layton, for two reasons. One is Layton may have known too much, and besides that, you find that his father, I'd like to give you this one at this time, just as a little follow-up. Philip Blakey was his brother-in-law. His father is Dr. Lawrence Layton. And Dr. Lawrence Layton is former chief of biochemistry and director of chemical warfare at the U.S. Army Dugway Proving Ground in Utah in the early 1950s. More recently, Dr. Layton has worked as a research scientist at the Western Regional Research Laboratory for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Berkeley, California. So you're tying Dr. Layton is chief of biochemistry and director of chemical warfare for the United States Army at a time that we had MK Ultra being started.
But then you said earlier that you thought Layton might have been under drugs and he might have had blanks in his gun. Would they have done that with his father?
The blanks in the gun would fit there because then it could prove he didn't fire anything, right?
But what about him being on drugs and then experiments?
I don't know. I'm only postulating here. I'm only guessing. But, you know, what's interesting to me is the way that this Blakey family is so tied into everything. And when you have key operatives, if you do have operatives, they have to be pretty tightly held, your key people.
Do you have any theories about Tim and Grace Stone that fit into this at all?
I don't know about Tim Stone. I know that Tim was, I saw a picture of Tim as a young man picked up in East Germany, in East Berlin, back in the mid-50s, as a student back there. Then he came back here and he gave up his Porsche and he gave up his good job and he went and joined Jim Jones. And the big fight that supposedly caused this, was given as a reason for the blow-up at Jonestown, was over this, whose son it was and all. So I'm getting to the point where I can't really tell legitimate, as I say in here, legitimate suspicion from paranoia. So you start looking at everybody and wondering, and I just don't know.
Thank you.
Let the night roar with it. They're out there. They're out there. They're listening. Let the night roar with it.
You're listening to Hard Rain on KALX Berkeley.
Let the night roar, because they can hear us. They know we mean it. We'll kill them if they come.
Actually, you're not listening to KALX. You are listening, of course, to KFJC. That just happened to be the broadcast in which that particular edited version was aired. And again, thanks to Eric Siegel, who edited that version together and whose voice you heard in voiceover, more or less the narrator, I guess, at the beginning and the end of the broadcast.
Worth noting for FCC purposes here that we do have the station's permission to play that, and that KALX is a sister station to this station, sharing the same faculty advisor.
Indeed, and good folks, too, on top of that. Okay, a couple of things real quickly to address, and again, the subject of Jonestown as a whole is something that we are going to want to address at much greater length and will probably be perhaps an entire Radio Free America broadcast. One of the things that kind of a canny point that was brought up by a young woman, the only time I think that she spoke during the thing of the people who are listening to this press conference by Jill Holtzinger, which was if Lawrence Layton Sr. had these contacts into U.S. military biochemical warfare and things like that, and was a bigwig as he was, why would Larry Layton Jr. wind up in the middle of this thing and perhaps to be accused of murder, et cetera, et cetera? Well, can't answer that one question particularly, but one of the interesting things that I've turned up, and we all have as we've researched this kind of stuff, is the number of times that people involved in these kinds of violent activities, these assassination attempts, these weird happenings, actually do turn out to be in important and connected families. Not just the Laytons, but for instance, the man who engineered the assassination of Orlando Letelier, who is a man by the name of Michael Vernon Townley, whose intelligence name was the Jackal. His family was an old CIA family that had been stationed in Santiago, Chile, for many, many years, and had a long-standing participation in the CIA. It was a well-known fact. So Michael Vernon Townley became involved with the CIA and eventually became a contract assassin. John Hinckley Jr., of course, the man who took a shot at Ronald Reagan, and many of us feel under somewhat strange circumstances, his father is the leader of an organization called World Vision, a putatively religious and charitable organization that nonetheless has had many allegations of connections to the CIA, including Christian Century magazine flat out calling it a CIA front.
don't know if he's actually the head guy, but he's one of the main officials.
I think you're right. I think he's on the board or something like that.
Yeah, because there's World Vision's getting a lot of publicity now in connection with the Ethiopian famine, and they usually have some other guy who's fronting as the head. So, but he is one of the driving forces behind the organization.
Right, and as I've mentioned several times in other shows, the Hinckleys are also well connected to the Bush family. George Bush, of course, former head of the CIA, and now our vice president.
Specifically, John Hinckley's older brother Scott was going to have dinner with Neil Bush, Vice President and former CIA Director Bush's son, the night after President Reagan was allegedly shot by John Hinckley, and they were also business partners.
Yeah, these things tend to be very, very incestuous, and so the fact that the Layton family was highly connected and that Larry Layton turned up in this sort of thing is not that surprising, and if we had the time, I would go into some other examples, but we really don't.
Summing up, though, some of the key details of what Mr. Holsinger, the Ryan aide, had to say. Note that the fact that initially there were 400 people reported dead for 5 days. They were looking for the other 500. No explanation as to there were 1,100 passports down to Guyana. Then the figure was reduced to 900. No explanation as to why that was reduced by 200. And they were looking for the other, they found 400 corpses, were looking for the other 500 for 5 or 6 days. And then they said, oops, here they are. They were under the other 400 all the time. We just didn't notice. Take a look at George Philip Blakey, CIA operative, worked with the UNITAR organization in Angola. He was the fellow who puts down the initial $650,000 down payment on the property in Guyana. Worth noting that the Angola operation was brought to a halt in part by the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, co-authored by Leo Ryan, which obliged the CIA to give Congress notification of impending covert operations. And take a look at the fact that Larry Layton Sr. was director of biochemistry and chemical warfare at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Interestingly, then he also went and worked on the Naval Rocket Propulsion Project, which I believe was in Annapolis, Maryland, or in somewhere in Maryland. He also worked for the Department of Agriculture. And note that Larry Layton Jr., his son, was the fellow who actually led the Port Kaituma death squad that killed Representative Ryan, among others. Larry Layton Jr.'s sister, Debbie Layton Blakey, was married to George Philip Blakey. Interestingly enough, the Philip family, Lisa Philip, eventually married Larry Layton Sr. and became Mrs. Lawrence Layton. She also joined the People's Temple. She came over from Germany, where her father was a lawyer for Siemens and Halske and also the IG Farben chemical conglomerate, which was an integral part of the Nazi war machine. They came over shortly before World War II. These are some of the key things to remember, and it's worth noting also that Mr. Holsinger's information came from, again, Mae Brussel, whose work is featured on this station.
Okay, a couple of other key details to tie up. During the course of the press conference, Joe Holsinger mentioned, and he didn't sound too actually sure about the original source for the information, but he mentioned that the Korean CIA had done the original funding to get the Unification Church, otherwise known as the Moonies, started on their road. Well, that particular information comes right out of the Tongson Park Korea Gate hearings that went on in the United States Congress and was originally published in the Toronto Star.
And also keep in mind, of course, that Richard Dwyer, CIA chief of mission, was at the Jonestown massacre, and Jones was urging them to get him out of there.
Okay, one last thing, and we talked earlier in the show several times about the strange ways, the coincidences that these people keep showing up in, where William Bryan, the psychiatrist, happened to be in the same church with David Ferry, and things of this nature that keep cropping up here and again, and how somebody else in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination case just happened to be one of his parishioners just happened to be the sister of Artie Bremmer, who was the man who shot George Wallace. All kinds of other interesting things. Well, we mentioned also several connections to James Earl Ray, and between James Earl Ray and some of the people involved in these particular cases, and allegations of his involvement with hypnosis, particularly. Well, interestingly enough, we talked earlier in the show very briefly about the flimsiness of the case against James Earl Ray, and without wanting to rehash the entire Martin Luther King assassination, which we did talk about at some length on the Guns of November broadcast when we did them, but essentially the government's entire case that James Earl Ray was the assassin of Martin Luther King was based on the testimony of one eyewitness. This particular gentleman, whose name is Charles...
I always forget his name. Keep talking. Come to me. I always forget his name.
Yeah, the name slipped my mind, too. Anyway, this particular man who was the only eyewitness that the government could get to pin James Earl Ray to the murder site from which supposedly Martin Luther King was shot.
Charles Q. Stevens.
Charles Q. Stevens, according to his common law wife, Grace Walden, was in fact at the time of the assassination, and Charles Stevens himself had admitted this to other people, was so drunk that he had no idea, or could possibly have had no idea of what had happened in the rooming house from which the shots were supposedly fired. Now, sometime after he had told this initial story, which was confirmed by mostly by his common law wife, Grace Walden, he was gotten to by the FBI. He turned around and suddenly became the only witness who could associate James Earl Ray with the murder site and claimed that he could had in fact seen James Earl Ray run out of the room where the rifle was found and could identify him, etc., etc. Now, this in and of itself was interesting in the fact that this was the only witness that the government could put together. They kept him, this admitted alcoholic, in a hotel for $30,000 worth of time while they were getting ready for the trial. But, as we mentioned earlier, coincidence is a fascinating thing, and what happened to Grace Walden is an even more interesting story.
Basically, a woman from the People's Temple who had been killed in an automobile accident, her passport had been saved, and Mark Lane, I recall Mark Lane achieved a great deal of notoriety in connection with the assassinations. He is one of the very few people who the mainstream press have covered in his espousal of conspiracy theories behind this country's major political assassinations. Most researchers regard Mark Lane as what is known in the intelligence community as a vacuum cleaner, an intelligence agent sent out to scoop up information. He is generally regarded himself as a U.S. intelligence agent, also works marvelously to discredit the valid research that's been done in this regard. Now, Mark Lane was at this time an attorney representing People's Temple. He also, at the time of the Jonestown Massacre, was representing James Earl Ray when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was holding hearings into the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. On November 18, 1978, when the massacre happened, the House Select Committee was in the middle of hearing testimony vis-a-vis the assassination of Martin Luther King, okay? And the Friday, as a matter of fact, before the Saturday of the massacre, a former FBI agent named Murtaugh, who had been stationed in the Atlanta FBI office, testified that when word came through that Dr. King had been shot, there was jubilation in the Atlanta FBI office, and that later on, when that there was more jubilation when they heard he'd died. He talked about FBI harassment of King and of attempts to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, and actually broke up in tears in the middle of the public hearings. That was one of the most dramatic moments in all of the hearings. Of course, after, now Mark Lane had been going on all sorts of stations, notably KGO here in the Bay Area, saying that Jonestown was a paradise on earth and so forth, and of course he was saying that the government killed Martin Luther King and that James Earl Ray was innocent. Not only did Jonestown overshadow the Martin Luther King hearings, but after that, Mark Lane looks like God's own fool after he is told, said that People's Temple is a paradise on earth. It turned out to be a hell on earth, and so by implication he makes James Earl Ray claim of innocence look bad. Now, Mark Lane, in his role as People's Temple attorney, had arranged for Grace Walden, or Grace Stevens, to go down on the passport of a woman who had been killed in an automobile accident to Jonestown. Had he been successful in doing that, she basically would have been at the Jonestown massacre and the main witness in refuting the only witness to link James Earl Ray to the rooming house from which he allegedly shot Dr. King would have been gone with the wind.
Indeed. So, once again, as we've seen, coincidence plays strange tricks, and at a certain point you begin to wonder, what is coincidence? And indeed, that is probably the subject alone of most of the debate about what we're talking about tonight, because the facts are there. The only question is how much of the linkage are you willing to make? And I think willing is a good word, because this is pretty scary stuff. I think that mind control is probably the last great gaping hole in the consciousness of most Americans. They're beginning to be able to accept the fact that assassinations have taken place, that we are not the only nation on earth ever to have been free of political assassinations. However, mind control is still a pretty scary thing, and we've just begun to address it tonight. We're probably going to have to spend some more time on it, and this will be a good opportunity, perhaps, though, for you to talk with us about the state of where we've gone so far and some of the things that we've discussed and maybe some things that have interested did you. We're going to take one last musical break while the phones are filling up. The line is 415-941-2500. Please call now, because as soon as this particular musical break ends, we are going to be going to the phones, and we will be staying on the phones uninterruptedly until 11 o'clock. So once again, the lines are now open. 415-941-2500 is the number. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Nip Tuck, along with Dave Emery, and we'll be back with a phone segment of Radio Free America in just a moment. Radio Free America, Mind Control Part 2. This is Nip Tuck. I'm here with Dave Emery, and we have got the phones open, 415-941-2500. We still have a couple of lines left open. I guess you guys are getting too smart for us out there, huh? You're not going to sit through the six-minute songs while you're running up your phone bills. Well, we tried. Anyway, 415-941-2500 is the number. And again, since we do have a limited amount of time tonight for telephone calls, please try and keep your phone calls as short as possible, okay? That will help us, and it will help the other people out there who want to get on the phones.
We do have two open lines. So, you know, if you want to call, and if those of you in particular, we get a lot of people who say they can't get through, they've been trying to call for weeks and weeks. Well, there are two open lines, so here's your chance.
Okay, anyway, back to the phones, and good evening, San Jose, and welcome to KFJC.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a book here by Brian Freemantle called simply CIA, put out by Stern and Day, and they mention several interesting points about the MKUltra program.
Okay.
One of them was that I don't think you mentioned how much they spent or the size of this, although the Candy Jones material gave you some indication. But to quote from this book here, they included a $150,000 a year contract with the Baltimore Laboratory experimenting with biological agents, and this was in addition to the CIA's liaison with the Army's Fort Detrick installation, to which the agency paid $100,000 a year. And John Marks, that wrote Search for the Manchurian Candidate, estimated the whole MK Ultra program cost $10 million.
Indeed, and John Marks also wrote another book too on, and besides the Search for the Manchurian Candidate, that also was about mind control, that the title of which skips my mind right now, but it'll come back to me. John Marks also was the person who collaborated with Victor Marchetti. If I got the name right, why is my brain seizing up on me tonight?
John Marks did cooperate with Victor Marchetti on CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. In
there
fact,
you go.
Marks was added to, at the insistence of the CIA, Marks was added to the authors of that book.
Indeed. We mentioned in the first series of these two broadcasts that we were reading from a book like Were We Controlled by Lincoln Lawrence, and he cites several instances there of talking about the vast amounts of money that were being handed out at that time to people like Dr. Jose Delgado, among others, and just several programs, some of them perhaps even outside the mantle of MKUltra, that were in different universities and medical facilities that were receiving money from the CIA. So the $10 million figure may even be a bit conservative.
Right. Also, it says here in the book, between 1955 and 58, and that's a few years before the Haight-Ashbury was popular, the Army tested LSD on 1,000 volunteer U.S. servicemen at Fort Bragg in the Army's Chemical Warfare Labs at Edgewood. And to satisfied with what they regarded as a lab test phase, the Army extended to Europe, and they did some experimenting over in Europe. And I saw in a Rolling Stone article a couple years ago, they think Lee Harvey Oswald may have been given some LSD when he was overseas.
Huh. Now, I hadn't heard that. It was this was in Rolling Stone?
Yes.
Huh. No, I'm interested. Do you know when that was approximately? I'd like to see that.
I don't know.
I think it was in January of 1983. I'm not sure. I think it was in early 83. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
I think it was February 83. And they say the incident where he shot off into the bushes or somewhere, nobody ever saw anyone around, but he shot off his weapon. They think maybe that was a flashback or something.
Okay.
Of course, the behavior of Lee Harvey Oswald is full of all kinds of red herrings. It appears from the circumstances of the JFK assassination that a number of different U.S. intelligence agents with a physical resemblance to Oswald were going all around and doing various aberrant things that were later to be attributed to Oswald as part of the painting of Oswald as a screwball. And it may be. I'm not saying it isn't, but you do have to be really careful when attributing things to Lee Harvey Oswald.
Indeed.
You can write anything you want.
Right. Just about, and probably find something to back it up, yes.
Right. One last point from this book. It said that in 1975, the CIA was buying 100 grams a week from Sandoz Laboratories of LSD. And to quote one more paragraph, in their hunt for that chemical material in Operation Big City, CIA adapted the tailpipe of a 1953 Mercury car, extending it 18 inches beyond its normal length, and drove for a total distance of 80 miles around New York, emitting a gas to see its effect upon innocent passersby. Operatives travel on the New York City subway with battery-driven emission apparatus and suitcases to see if LSD could be sprayed in a confined space and affect people. The operatives themselves wore nasal filter pads. And last but not least, biological gas was released off the Golden Gate Bridge to cover San Francisco and disorient the population, but the wind blew it away before it could cause any harm.
You know, the very, just even granting the purposes behind these kinds of things that the Central Intelligence Agency must have had, the sloppiness of the kind of work being done suggests not people only who were out of control from a political sense, but people who probably themselves were not really mentally healthy. I mean, the idea of driving around New York, you know, emitting chemicals from the tailpipe of a car in hopes of seeing sort of at random what effect it might have. I mean, how do you measure that kind of thing? You know, I mean, not just putting aside the amount of damage to people you might cause is just sort of evidence of
not only that, but if I was driving around New York City, I wouldn't want the person next to me to be dosed on acid. Seriously, you know, I mean, I do think though that again, to a certain extent at least, the legacy of Galen and the Nazi intelligence group is evident here, and that the willingness to use human beings as experimental subjects, as experimental guinea pigs, is front and center here.
All right, well, our government has never achieved the efficiency of the Hitler regime.
Yeah, well, thank goodness for that.
Okay, well, thank you.
Not so we have ever been told.
Thanks for your call, caller. Bye-bye. Okay, 415-941-2500. I noticed the line blinking a couple times and people dropping off. I don't know what that is. Maybe that's just fear.
Well, we have three open lines now, so if you have anything to say, here's a good opportunity to say it.
Yeah, this is a rather unusual circumstance, actually, because usually after we finish these shows or when we do the regular shows, people are pounding and kicking, and it looks like, as I said to somebody earlier tonight, it looks like the evacuation of Saigon, you know, with people clawing each other to get on board. So we do have lines open at 415-941-2500 if you want to give us a call on something. Okay, go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. One of the things that's interesting in terms of mind control is something that we might extend out a little bit is, it's apropos of what that last caller said, is the fact that the intelligence agencies have also been very much involved in spreading drugs of all kinds throughout the various layers of our society. We've talked at some length on this station about the Nugent Hand Bank. We've taken a look at, which is a naval intelligence and CIA project out of Australia, which was involved in arms smuggling and drug smuggling. We've taken a look at the CIA role in smuggling heroin from Southeast Asia. And, of course, the Great Heroin Coup, which talks about not only the Southeast Asian heroin traffic, but that coming out of the Middle East as well, the so-called it's not the Golden Triangle. What is the area that Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran? What do they call it? Is that the Golden Triangle? But it's
it's got a different name. But
at any rate, that is of course another way of controlling populations is to get them hooked up on drugs. And one of the things that's interesting, you know, we talk so often about IG Farben and about the Nazi connections. Worth noting that heroin was developed by IG Farben originally as a cough suppressant for especially effective for children, which I've no doubt that it is. And they also developed methadone, which was initially a synthetic narcotic to be used during World War II and was called dolefine in honor of Adolf Hitler. And, of course, it was Albert Hoffman working for, I believe it was Sandoz at the time, or maybe Hoffman the Roach, I'm not sure. At any rate, the initial discovery of LSD was done by a company that was under contract to IG Farben. So, and, of course, the Philip family, the woman who married Lawrence Layton, their family is connected to IG, so the long tentacles of IG figure in here as well.
Indeed, it do go on. Okay, we still have one line left open at 415-941-2500. Give us a call. Let us know what's on your mind. Good evening, Los Gatos, and welcome to Radio Free America.
Good evening. How are you folks?
Just fine.
Hey, what do you think of Cota or Cato, whatever the fellow's name was that had the jail in his house in San Jose?
Yeah, interesting. You mean the fellow who
busted out of, well, he didn't bust out of jail from Texas, but they knew exactly what his background was, and they pretty much let him walk from Texas into California and just left him sit in a Second Street apartment.
Okay, now this is for the listeners who are not familiar. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that this was the gentleman who was pulled over with the body of a young woman in the back of his van and shot himself, allegedly, in front of these police officers.
Said, "I'm not worth it," and put a gun to his head and bang, bang.
Yeah, or his chest, I think it was.
Oh, well.
Yeah, well, again, it's one has to be very careful, of course, not to get too deeply into the aura of conspiracy because of the fact that, yeah, so many of these things are so strange. And, again, you know, again, especially when you're talking about these mind control things, because the information is so tenuous. You know, what is conspiracy, what is not, what is real, what is not. Certainly, as you said, there's certainly some you know, law enforcement questions, if nothing else, that have to be asked about a man who can do those things and be under some kind of very loose surveillance, I gather, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's certainly the question is there. Now, as to whether he was part of anything or not, I mean, you know, certainly have to have more information than we have at this point.
Well, it's worth noting that he got out of prison in Texas. He'd also been in the army in Germany before that. I don't know. It looks suspicious to me.
You know, now, again, as long as we're conspiracy mongering, right, and admitting the fact that this is pure and simple conspiracy mongering, and this is not based on the kind of hard evidence we were using earlier in the show.
In other words, what we're doing now, we want to distinguish between the documentation we presented. This is pure speculation. So,
I agree. I agree.
Well, let me throw something else out that kind of struck me recently. Now, there was another case that just happened with, and again, this case has not come to court yet, so we have to be legally fair about this. There are allegations that this man had kept a woman as a quote-unquote sex slave for 7 years.
Uh-huh,
okay.
In Reading.
Right, I'm sure you read about that.
Yep.
Now, again, these are only allegations at this point. The man has not been tried. He's innocent until proven guilty. However, one of the allegations that the woman made was that the man had told her that there was a kidnapping ring that was operating that was responsible for kidnapping women, selling them off for things, doing this, that, and the other thing. Now, the reason it was interesting to me is because we spent a long time on this station working on what we call the Valerie McDonald case. The Valerie McDonald case was a case that of a woman who disappeared in San Francisco under very mysterious circumstances, whose family's private investigators said that they believed, because of the connections that the kidnappers had, that this was some kind of an intelligence drug running and gun smuggling case. And apparently, it seemed as though these people were not only involved in gun running and drug smuggling, but were also running some kind of a kidnapping ring. Valerie McDonald's body or live person was never found. And the people involved in the case, especially this one man named Philip Thompson, kept walking in and out of jail about every 5 days. They'd bring him in, and somebody would slip the judge a fake memo, and he'd get released, and they'd bring him in again, and all kinds of strange things.
Interesting to note that Donald DeFries, the Cinque Quay of the Symbionese Liberation Army, also had a remarkably easy time walking out of prisons.
Yeah, so again, just purely on the grounds of it's not based on anything except just, again, sheer coincidence in this case, and not like the other stuff we put together that we have documentation for.
One thing I will toss out, and again, this is totally speculative, right at the beginning of this year, right at the very beginning of 1984, an interesting article appeared in the news and was brought up on One Step Beyond a couple of times, and that concerned the death of a guy named Dr. Merlino Cremata, last name Cremata. Now, he was a psychotherapist who was practicing in the Bay or in the South Bay here in San Jose, specifically affiliated with the Latino community. And he was formerly the chief psychiatrist for Batista's army in Cuba. And of course, the Batista people then fled to the United States, opposed Castro, and became very, very much, very closely affiliated with CIA. Cremata was involved with the Bay of Pigs invasion and later escaped. And he was a practicing psychotherapist in the Bay Area who had documented intelligence connections. Interestingly enough, he was also a devotee of Carl Jung. And for all of Jung's many achievements, Jung himself was not only the co-editor of the Nazi Psychiatric Quarterly, co-edited with Matthias Goering, the cousin of Hermann Goering, but Jung was also very close to the Dulles brothers, both Alan and John Foster Dulles. Alan, of course, CIA director, John Foster, Secretary of State under Eisenhower, during much of the time that Alan was CIA director. What you make of that, I don't know, but when I saw him die of an apparent heart attack, I just wondered, and I'm still wondering, whether we were going to be hit here in the South Bay with a lot of these people who just snap and you know, start firing off of a building into crowds. No, seriously, it occurred to me we might be seeing a lot of lone nuts here in the Bay Area, and people may wonder, well, why would they do that? it serves as a, you know, just these random murders, whether or not they're being caused by somebody, but they certainly serve to shore up the law and order advocates in the society, people who
That's
advocate broader police powers and a consequent erosion of civil liberties, plus the fact that that's the sort of thing gets people very, very upset and pushes them that much closer to the brink. And if what you want is fascism, if you want to get people to just break out in a sort of king hell rage, then that's one way of building up the internal pressure cooker.
That's true. One last thing before I let you folks get on. That fellow in Reading,
right?
Did you read or hear about the hypnotism and the mind control that he was using, that he actually had articles of hypnosis and he used it to control his victim in the box?
Well, again, allegations, but
that's,
yeah, I have heard the allegations that were made by the woman that indeed there was some type of hypnosis and stuff like that going on, which was one of the reasons that I found it interesting.
And of course, the Patty Hearst syndrome has been suggested in connection with that case.
Right.
Well, have a good evening, gentlemen.
Okay.
Thank you.
We sure will. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, 415-941-2500 with a line open.
Two lines open,
son of a gun. Good evening, Campbell, and welcome to KFJC.
Yes, sir. You're doing a good job. I'm very pleased to hear what you're talking about this evening. We'll leave you with a quick thing here. Jonestown seems like it was just last week, and everybody said it would never happen again in this country, and now we have an Indian Jim Jones in Oregon.
Ah, yes, the Rajneeshis.
Right, that's pretty scary. Could you talk about that for a few minutes, and I'll listen on my radio.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you much.